ground is now.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1006.JE3122, certificate number 29297, the public universal friend.
To allies and strangers, all those you endure, the rights of all living things fight to uphold. So may you grow old.
I guess if you're finding this show in an underground archive in the year 4000, maybe we'll categorize the show. Maybe we'll have a little Dewey Decimal System here. Because all of our, maybe you found all the shows about unusual colonial American religion together.
Oh, I see.
Because we are doing, gradually this is becoming a show about unusual colonial American religion.
And cars. And cars and airplanes.
If you're in the far future, you don't know that every Tuesday, I did a show about the Great Awakening, and then on Thursday, John did a show about some quickly discontinued model of car.
Or weird airplane or Hitler.
Hitler in a weird airplane. Hitler, maybe Hitler in a car that gets crashed into by a weird airplane? I don't know. That would be the ideal omnibus.
Sure, that's the Tarantino omnibus. I like to think of myself as the public universal friend. I think of you that way, too.
We should all be the public universal friend.
A public universal friend. I just like the...
In our day, the public universal friend is...
There is none.
Tom Hanks? I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Ever since Fred Rogers died, the post has been empty.
But it does vacant. Feel like a thing you could say to yourself on the way out the door. Like...
Today?
Yeah.
I will be, to all, a public universal friend.
A public universal friend.
It's a great name, and it's maybe the more interesting part of this show is that it's somebody's name.
You usually love an acronym, and you haven't said PUF yet.
I think in writing about the public universal friend, people do sometimes say PUF.
Yeah.
Even scholars, because it's difficult to refer to the public universal friend. Let me explain first off, even though we did Thomas Jefferson's Bible, like exactly 1 week ago,
right,
in our era, we're doing the Public Universal Friend today. It's a request show from a listener named Alex, who also requested some other great shows that have already been on my list, like Emperor Norton I of San Francisco, the DMZ tree cutting incident of the 1970s.
Yep.
Those are things we had already been thinking of doing, but they just did not have the Great Awakening in upstate New York. And so I found myself drawn to the tale of the public universal friend.
Is there a brand of public universal friend silverware by any chance?
The public universal friend is a person. And just to give it away at the top.
Or puff,
as we call the friend. It's difficult to, this can't be a turns out, because throughout this story, the way you refer to the public universal friend is a big part of the friend's story, because the friend in the friend's life preferred not to use any pronouns at all to refer to the friend.
Oh, the friend.
Yeah.
Okay.
So scholars today writing about the friend sometimes tend to start with she and wind up in he or they. But the friend, I guess, occasionally would use he when push came to shove to refer to the friend's self. But really, the friend would just prefer if everyone around the friend just said the friend all the time, even the second time the friend appears in the sentence where the friend already appeared.
You know, now we have a the style guide dictates that we use the pronoun of a person we're discussing, the pronoun that they prefer.
Yes.
And
that they would be okay for a singular referent.
Right. But is that true? I mean, you make it sound like scholars are not clear retroactively on how to refer to the friend. And if someone wants to just be called the friend, in every instance you would use a pronoun.
Does it make you sound dumb when you're writing about the friend and every time you say the friend's name, you have to call the friend the friend?
The more I say the friend or hear you say the friend, I actually start to conjure the friend.
I almost think there should be no pronouns because it has this kind of lyrical, repetitive quality when you keep having to say the original noun every time in a sentence.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Pronouns are a lazy person's language.
Yeah.
Why don't we just keep saying the mail truck. I was talking to Ken Jennings, and Ken Jennings said that today he was going to dress like a... Oh, I used he. It slipped
See?
In.
See?
Today, Ken Jennings was going to dress like a postman.
They. The problem is personal pronouns. I mean, what do you say for I? That's the pronoun that's hard to get rid of.
John Roderick. If I just refer
John to... John Roderick is here.
Yeah, just refer to John Roderick as John Roderick, because you wouldn't even be able to say myself.
No, if you're some kind of grandiose narcissist who always refers to John Roderick's self in the third person, then it comes very easy to you. Hey, John Roderick's at the party. Hey, John, what's up?
I do like it. Just the repetitiveness of the friend, but it also starts to conjure like a purple dinosaur. In the sense
like it's a little sticky sweet. Like, I think it may become a little creepy.
Yeah, the friend feels a little bit like Not Me from Family Circus.
I always thought it was very ominous. Yeah, exactly. I always thought it was a very ominous one. I see that clip of Mr. Rogers saying, look for the helpers.
Yeah.
Because I always imagined the helpers to be some kind of cloaked race with glowing eyes.
Yes. The helpers are very tall and they are the like sleestacks.
When I see a disaster on TV, I look for the helpers and only I can see them.
When I'm alone in my house, I look for the helpers and they're there.
Because today that's the trend in horror. Is it something like the friend or the helpers that then turns out not to be friendly or helpful? Right.
I wonder what kind of movie it would be. Would it still be a horror movie? It kind of might be if the friends and helpers are actually friendly and helpful, but still glowing-eyed, like 10-foot-tall.
Yeah, what about a movie where people start reading about a tall, spindly visitor called the Babadook in children's poetry, and then it just turns out to be just a cute, helpful guy.
Yeah, he's
the Babadook shows up and he's just like a Dr. Seuss.
Super benign, yeah. Like, oh, you left the stove on, but I turned it off for you. And
Mommy, I was outside and the Babadook helped me find this. And she's super happy. Oh, that's the button that fell off my coat, Timmy.
Yeah, exactly. It's a four-leaf clover.
Thank you, Babadook.
I feel like that may be the next, you know, the new earnestness. Maybe it's time for there to be horror movies that are, you know, that end up feeling good.
The thing is, does the music and photography style stay horror movie the whole way through, even when pleasant and wholesome things are happening?
Like the walls start to bleed, but it's honey.
That's the nicest thing you can think of to bleed.
Well, yeah, what maybe. Else is it going to bleed? Like hydraulic fluid.
Applesauce. I don't know. Coors.
All of that is bad to clean up. Coors.
Yeah, I mean, the honey immediately made me think, ew, I don't want that. It's going to look like some H.R. Geiger room if the walls are bleeding honey.
It's cool if you like...
Basically, you don't want your walls to bleed anything, I'm fine.
Yeah,
no matter right. what the...
The more I think
No matter
about
how delightful
it.
The substance.
I mean, man, liquid gold, but then the house is going to burn down. That's very hot.
I guess I just looked up languages without pronouns, and Japanese apparently is as close as you can come.
Does Korean have pronouns?
It does. In Japanese, there are words that function as pronouns. There's ways to essentially say I or whatever, but they all just mean a noun. Like I is essentially humble servant or something.
Right.
So when you say I go to the store, you know, your Japanese listener would hear I go to the store, but literally what you're saying is your humble servant goes to the store.
So there's no, is Japanese gender free?
Yeah, I mean, there are languages without gendered pronouns too. I don't think Japanese is. Well, that's a good question. And you know what? Let's leave it to the listeners.
Okay. Yeah, please write us at omnibusproject@gmail.com.
When we're two steps removed from the subject of the show, I still look things up. Yeah. When it hits three, I'm like, Do I want to Google this? A little bit, but...
We'll do it in a different show.
I always kind of want to Google the thing. Anyway, so this is by way of saying that, you know, you can't make it a cool twist when gender rears its head in this story because you're making a political choice no matter how you refer to the friend. The friend, when the friend was born in 1752 in Cumberland, Rhode Island, the friend was assigned the gender at birth of female and the name of Jemima Wilkinson.
Jemima.
Which was... Jemima's a good name.
It is a good name.
But it's been cursed by years of the...
Syrup.
The, yeah.
And the walls bleeding syrup.
Hey.
Whoa.
What about walls that bleed maple syrup? That's pretty good.
Yeah. If you live in the forest, you could make a case that the walls do.
It's a Canadian's dream. But yeah, I mean, Jemima's kind of a... It's also a benevolently racist caricature, or maybe not even benignly. It's... Jemima's probably out of style for that reason.
Yeah, hard to know.
But in Britain, I think it has its own life.
There's Jemima.
There's a Beatrix Potter. There's Jemima Puddle Duck of, you know, 19th century children's literature.
I cannot divorce the name from the caricature. So the idea of it being an ancient English
to you
name.
It's always an African-American caricature.
Yeah, someone with the...
Isn't one of the kids in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang named Jemima?
You know, I've been meaning to watch Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
I can save you some time.
Oh, is that right? It's not good. It's a flying car.
I was just watching the Kenneth Branagh movie Belfast, and a lot of that movie is about Chitty Chitty Bang Bang nostalgia.
Really?
It essentially implies that Kenneth Branagh became a film director and a theater legend because of the wonders of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Wow.
So imagine a universe without it.
I also felt a great deal of wonderment about Chitty Chitty Bang Bang at the time.
I was just scared of the child catcher or whatever he's called, who is the Babadook of his day.
The friend.
Look out for the helpers. Yes, one of the kids in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is named Jemima Potts. Hmm. And of course, Jemima Kirk from Girls. But these are all British people. The name is biblical. It's one of the three daughters of Job.
Oh.
I think it's the replacement daughters and not the original daughters.
Sure.
You know how bands, you know, sometimes the Temptations have replacement members?
Hey, you don't have to tell me.
It happened to Job. The Temptations were not replacing their, like, leprosy-killed members. None of the Temptations died of boils, as far as I'm aware.
No, although there's still an opportunity for a Temptation to die of boils. I feel like my band is going to replace me, although I'm the driving force.
The lone member.
Yeah. It's going to be like the...
Has that ever happened? Has like a one-man band ever replaced the one man?
Well, no, but like in Creedence, the three guys were like, we're just going to slightly change the name.
Yeah, I think we all, you know, we've seen lead singerless versions of these bands.
Right, right.
But I'm imagining like somebody touring as the Mountain Goats in 50 years.
Oh, and it's just...
And it's not John
Darnielle's like second cousin.
Some guy who played keyboard for him at his last show at a county fair in 81.
I can't think of a version of that. Although, wait a minute. No, it's always that there's a band tour, like the Aquabats. I don't know if there's any original member of the Aquabats in the current touring
right.
Aquabats.
Well, Job got three replacement daughters. The sons are not named, but one of the daughters is named Jemima. And this explains why in colonial America you would give a little girl the eighth of 12, or a friend whom you then took for a girl. You know, even in recent years, it's not clear what the implications of this story are for feminist scholarship, for colonial scholarship, for religious scholarship, for transgender and non-binary scholarship. So this is just going to be a hash pronoun-wise, and please send your letters to John Roderick, P.O. Box 55744.
Yes, please make them a paper letter. I will only answer a paper letter on this topic.
Now, it's not a coincidence that the friend, then erroneously known as Jemima Wilkinson, was born in Rhode Island. Rhode Island being, of course, the
colony formed by a man who was kicked out of Massachusetts.
Yeah, the colony of miscellany, I guess. Uh-huh. It was somebody, if you weren't Puritan enough for the Puritans, or possibly too Puritan for the Puritans.
That's the thing. Which is it?
Roger Williams left Massachusetts because his ideas were a little too nutty for the pilgrims.
They were.
He thought every hat should have two buckles. And they were like, no, one. Exactly one. And as a result, for decades thereafter, Rhode Island was the place where freethinkers and dissidents of all kinds went.
Even still.
Yeah, if you're a Quaker today, by law, you are you, your kindergarten teacher tracks you to Rhode Island,
right,
and there you stay.
It's the last place where the mafia really thrives.
In Rhode Island, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
They control the trash routes and the Quaker congregations.
So. I believe so.
Jemima, we only have a few notes about the friend's childhood when the friend was still known as Jemima. Apparently the friend was very into horses.
Yep.
Horseback riding.
Checks out.
So possibly, again, a freighted term, but what we would have called in our era as like maybe tomboyish, athletic.
Hmm. Well, horsey girls are a breed apart.
Maybe. Literally.
Right.
Yeah. But in this case also, you know, athletic and outdoorsy, mm-hmm. You know, possibly a rough and tumble kind of girl, but also very gift or kind of friend, but also, you know, gifted, you know, reading very early, could recite biblical and Quaker texts. Her family is affiliated with the Society of Friends in Cumberland, Rhode Island, mm-hmm. Which is a name for the Quakers.
Right.
And is where the friend appellation comes from.
Also true of David Byrne.
Oh yeah. I was like, David Byrne took on a transgender, non-binary identity.
Born in 1750s? No, but no, he went to RISD, right? And was a Quaker.
Not everyone at RISD is a Quaker, surely. What if they were?
Can you confirm that?
What if it's a hotbed of Quaker art? every time you say this on the show, I say just like Richard Nixon. So let me say right now, yes, and right. Richard Nixon.
And Richard Nixon.
And Richard Nixon.
Was a Quaker and went to the Rhode Island School of Design. And he tried to whip inflation, but not now.
In general, this is a good etiquette. If anyone ever mentions David Byrne in conversation, you should always say, and Richard Nixon. Just like how in your house.
Yes, in bed.
No, okay, there's that. I was thinking about at the end of saying grace when someone says amen.
Right.
Your family always says, this is the way.
Yes, we do.
From The Mandalorian.
Yes, we say, well, because our family, Grace, was developed by my then 9-year-old daughter, and so she included this is the way at the end.
And it was my fault. She saw my family
she say loved a quick your
prayer
grace.
Before dinner.
Well, you would describe it as a quick prayer. Maybe it's a quick prayer in your tradition.
It was only 8 minutes, John. did your soup get cold?
Fairly extensive prayer by our standards.
But well, let's please bless the following foods. The fish sticks, the tater tots, the tartar sauce. On this day of plenty. That's like on holidays where like the family patriarch feels like you really gotta roll out the big prayer today.
Oh, my Uncle Junius on Thanksgiving would always stand up at the head of the table.
Like a Norman Rockwell dad.
Yeah, and he would have Thanksgiving dinner at his house, I think, expressly in order to have an audience for this, and give an entire like Seder long lecture on Thanksgiving.
Wait, does each food have a symbolism like at Seder?
Well, I think
the Brussels sprouts
yeah, they
represent
do, because it's like this was my grandmother's creamed onion recipe, and these green beans came all the way from Kentucky.
The French fried onions represent the crisp Massachusetts winters faced by the early settlers.
But he always had some spin on everything that was just eye-rolling because he was, you know, from a generation in my family of orators. And so my sister and
hard
I would just elbows on the table. Like,
but now everyone who listens to any of your shows has, you know,
yeah.
gets karmic revenge.
Yeah, they're great. They're grateful. No,
you're passing it forward.
That I was raised this way. But no, so we had you over for dinner the other night, and my daughter asked if you would say the grace, and you did. And then at the end, we all said, your family included,
this is the way.
This is the way.
We agreed beforehand that there would be a nod to the Judeo-Christian God.
Right. We said
amen. And then there would be a nod to our true God, Disney Plus.
We said, this is the way. And I noticed, you know, the three Jennings all, you know, kind of
was it dutiful?
Well, no, you hesitated over this is the way. Not sure if it was. I mean, we had a little theological discussion.
Like we would be smoten.
Well, but we concluded that this, if we were saying a prayer to the Judeo-Christian God, it would be the way.
I mean, that was your point, that this yeah. is the way really just emphasizes the content of any prayer.
It is the way.
Muslims should be saying it.
Right. This
Buddhists
is the way.
Should be saying it.
And we say it in a secular way. This is the way.
You should just add it to whatever mantra or chant you do.
And Nixon.
And Nixon. And so it'd be. But sadly, the Quaker heritage of the friend does not last into adulthood. By the time the friend is in the friend's early, it's not that hard when you get into a rhythm of it, in the late teens or early 20s, about the time we all have a religious awakening.
But the Friends are the Quakers. It's another way of referring to the Quakers.
Quakers is, I think, maybe started out as a pejorative, right?
Right, because they quake.
The more traditionalist religious people were like, they need to stop doing all that fervor.
With that quaking.
Stop the fervor already. So, it's not well behaved.
But when you say the Friends possessive.
Sorry. I mean the friend apostrophe is.
Yeah, that's the little, it's, gets a little.
Is this why pronouns exist? Have we reverse engineered the reason for personal pronouns?
You know what? I'm not going to take a stand on pronouns on this show.
You don't want letters.
I don't. Well, no, if I do want letters.
If you're annoyed that John is not taking a stand on pronouns and is thus insufficiently supportive of the cause.
No.
Please write
not right.
to John
no,
Roderick.
No, I'm not taking a stand on pronouns because I am.
You're so supportive of
I'm
them.
I'm very supportive of the, of, and I don't, what it is I don't feel like I can speak
right.
authoritatively about pronouns. I'm going to take my cues from, I'm going to read the room on pronouns.
Perhaps it's our time to listen
as
cis white men.
And so let's get back to the conversation where it's just you and me talking.
No, let's just listen. The rest of the show will be like a Quaker meeting. It'll be utter silence until one of us is moved upon by the Spirit. Do you honestly think somebody like whistles a wind at Quaker
services? Have you ever been to a Quaker service?
Is there somebody whistling into a mic?
No, but they're all in very drafty, uninsulated wooden structures, and you hear the wind.
That's part of their theology.
Come in through the cracks in the windows.
In the 1770s, when the Friend is now a young person, the Friend has a religious conversion from the Quaker religion to what at the time is called the New Lights Baptists.
Called the New Lights Baptist by whom?
By New Lights Baptists and Old Lights Baptists alike. So this is not a term I had heard before, but I guess it was super common into the 19th century when there was any like religious schism in a denomination. Instead of saying Orthodox and Reform or Prairie Synod or whatever you would say today,
right?
The thing at the time would be no matter what the distinction was or the theological difference was, you would just say, "Oh, are you Old Lights or New Lights?"
I didn't know that.
I had never heard this before.
That's crazy.
And in trying to track down what it meant, it's actually unclear because it means something different in every case. Old Lights Congregationalism, Old Lights Baptists, it's different in every case.
New Lights feels like the name of one of these hipster churches that play rock and roll, like that are in a mini mall.
Hey, I want to tell you about your public universal friend. And he was a carpenter from Galilee.
Come on down to New Lights where we have rock and worship.
Well, I just don't think the Old Lights people would stand by it. Like New Lights makes it seem like, hey, we've received new light. We've received new divine light from God. And that's why we're doing infant baptism the correct way over here. And look at these yo-yos over on 10th Street. They're still doing it the weird Old Lights way.
Although it's weird when you think of like the term conservative, if you digest it, is kind of pejorative.
How but, so? They want to conserve things.
Well, yeah, but it just
there are
feels
things
like,
you and I like to conserve: forests, jams, and jellies.
True.
But
it
that's
does.
About it.
It does. It does feel very. It's very descriptive of. It doesn't feel very modern.
Right.
Right. So Old Lights might feel.
Maybe that's the idea.
Like, yeah, they might be like, yeah, hey, that's right.
We have the
original lights.
We have history on our side and the power of tradition and precedence.
When did that fall out of favor?
It was actually during the Ford administration when the Old Lights and New Lights Symbionese Liberation Army broke up. No, I did not see cases after the Second Great Awakening. So this is very much a did not survive the Civil
the
War.
The first flu. Oh, Civil War. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean.
Sure, that makes sense.
I mean 19th century. So her family, I did it. See, the friend's family starts to separate from the local Quaker congregation. And in fact, you can see in turn.
Well, the whole family does.
Well, it's the friend first, then Jemima. And then Jemima's, what, 11 brothers and sisters? This happens over a period of time. And it's partly because of doctrinal disagreements. You know, the friend appears to enjoy the fervor and charisma of the Baptist church down the way and not the staid Quakers in which the friend has grown up. But a lot of the family's movement away from the Quakers is a result of what follows. In the year 1776.
I've heard of it.
America's War
of Independence.
A daring guerrilla war for independence being mm-hmm. fought in the dales of Pennsylvania and
New Jersey. Yeah.
Where all great wars take place.
Massachusetts.
The
Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah. There were battles in Brooklyn Heights.
Yeah.
Manhattan even. A Continental Army ship called the Columbus pulls into Providence Harbor, full of British prisoners. And then as now, the British prisoners were all full of one thing.
Rum.
Two things. Rum, digestive biscuits, three things. Rum, digestive biscuits, and typhus.
Oh.
So a wave of what now historians believe to be typhoid fever races through the cities and towns of Rhode Island, all three of the cities and towns of Rhode Island.
Killing all the swamp Yankees.
And the friend's self is brought low by this fever, what they're calling the fever.
Yeah.
Which is really, you know, even by the
fever,
it was not the cool kind of sexy Eartha Kitt fever. Like even by the math of today's kind of scary pandemic, like it's just another order of magnitude back then where like literally all your neighbors have it and you're pretty sure a bunch of people in each house are going to die. I mean, that's something even in our terrifying global pandemic, we don't have to live with.
Well, and also then someone in every house or multiple people in every house die. You have 12 brothers and sisters, so that could be as many as 5 to 7 people.
Right.
And there's no...
Luckily, you've got replacement...
You do.
Replacement joke kids everywhere.
But there's nowhere for those bodies to go, right? Yeah. An ambulance doesn't come. So now you're dealing with 5 pestilential children bodies.
Children's bodies. And this is where the horror genre comes from.
Yeah.
The friend takes to the friend's sick bed at the age of 23 and actually falls into what appears to be a coma and is on the brink of death. And in fact, in the friend's own account, the friend dies and has a glorious vision of archangels with white robes and golden crowns. And the person named Jemima Wilkinson stays dead. But the archangels return that body to life in the new identity of the public universal friend.
Well.
So it's a superhero origin story.
Yes.
PUF begins.
Yes. Bitten by a radioactive spider.
Bitten by a radioactive Quaker.
Okay. Well, I'm with this 100%.
Now, in the 19th century, there was a lot of anti-PUF scholarship. Most of the writing about the public universal friend was suspicious and aimed at discrediting the friend and the friend's movement and the friend's work.
Because all those writers were also busy writing long exegeses on phrenology.
And True science had advanced past this silly charismatic religion of the 19th century, and we were into eugenics now.
Right.
We'd finally found something real. So these 19th century writers would say none of this ever happened. There was no typhoid
Come
epidemic.
On. Oh, wait a minute. They deny the typhoid epidemic?
Yeah, they're basically anti-vaxxers, I guess.
Seems like that would be in the...
There's not even a pandemic.
Wasn't there didn't other people write letters?
Basically, the illness was fake. There was no such coma. This is all reverse. This is, you know, later revisionism to explain. But in fact, this is a big change in the public universal friend's life. Immediately, the friend tells the friend's family, no longer refer to me as Jemima. In fact, no longer refer to me as a girl or woman.
Friend recovers.
I'm not a she or her anymore. Yeah, the friend rises from a deathbed in, you know, what seems to be miraculous fashion, which really bolsters the friend's story of archangels and a new life, and says that...
Are we sure the friend isn't a Highlander?
There could be only one, mm-hmm. I guess. There was no public universal friend appointed when the public universal friend died, so
okay,
maybe there is no. That's why it's still vacant today, until Fred Rogers. Another kind of genderless Quaker type from the Northeast.
Sure.
The friend decides that from now on, the friend will not be wearing a female-identifying clothing anymore. Female-coded clothing of any kind,
which might have been
or styling
more controversial even than calling oneself the female or the universal friend.
Look, this would all have been super weird in a high school 10. I mean, not weird, but this would have all been raised some eyebrows in a high school 10 years ago. Imagine in 1776 America, even Rhode Island.
Right.
This was all very unconventional. The friend, you know, because the friend sees the friend as having a new religious mission, the friend begins to wear clerical robes.
I see.
And if you think about a clerical robe, it combines male and female fashion. You've got kind of a flowing, what, dress or skirt, but you also have like male tailoring up top, right? There's a, maybe a collar, and yeah, another kind of male-coded, masculine-coded stuff,
sure,
up top. So, and you know, they're kind of black or maybe a royal purple. So it's a hybrid look. You know, you could say it's the first kind of Annie Hall,
uh-huh,
kind of
big wide tie tucked Diane into a vest, Keaton
floppy hat at the Golden Globes kind of outfit. But also it's using the idea of clerical or angelic robes to just get away from any gender convention.
Are angels gendered?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, there is, if the friend is identifying the friend self with angels, angels are often depicted as kind of sexless.
Yeah, they sort of transcend gender, don't they? You can't imagine angels getting it on, really.
I mean, this is a theological squabble for centuries. You know, are the angels a separate race created by God? When did he create them? You know, how human are their attributes?
How many can dance on that have been?
I mean, this was, the deists loved angels because they could, the deists could kind of hand wave away miracles by saying, of course, God follows a natural order. And part of that order was he created a bunch of angels who can come do miracles. So,
right,
you know, we've solved all the theological problems.
The uncaused cause.
I mean, you've even got Galatians 3:28, which says, you know, in Christ there is no more male and female. Hmm. And, you know, Paul's take there is to say that all societal divisions are gone. There's no more black or white, you know, racial divisions, class divisions, religious divisions. There's no more Jew and Gentile. There's no more bond and free. You know, political distinctions like slave don't exist, because the Christian identity unites and supersedes all. But that would, you know, there's neither male nor female in Christ would have a very deep meaning to someone like the friend,
right,
who is now staking out this new genderless or post-gender ground. As part of, the friend wears short hair in the front, but ringlets in the back. So
hey, business in front,
male business in front. So it's, again, the hairstyle is kind of, and this is when the family decides that they are into the public friend.
Oh, so the friend is convincing, and of the 12 children, the friend seems to be setting the tone.
The friend now becomes a religious figure with a mission, like a pastoral and ecclesiastical responsibility to spread this new word of a new kind of religion. The friend keeps a lot of the Quaker principles, including being anti-slavery. The friend, mm-hmm, was, the public universal friend was publicly anti-slavery, but and the Quaker acceptance of celibacy, the friend really ramps up, you know, as you might expect, given the friend's new kind of genderless or non-binary, we would say, coding. The friend also says that, you know, what's really best is celibacy. That's a very challenging teaching in,
for oneself or for everyone?
I think it's challenging. It's better for everyone.
Hmm.
And it's a challenging teaching back then, especially for women, where pretty much the only responsibility of women in society is to not be celibate. You know, be a fruitful wife and mother, and that's about it there is for you. So these Quaker ideas of celibacy, ramped up to 11 by the public universal friend, are really revolutionary as far as how women are treated back then. Because if a woman is celibate, suddenly the doors are now open. You know, a woman without hearth and kids can do whatever.
Right.
And, you know, the patriarchy doesn't love that. It's unusual for a woman to preach at all, which is why, you know, the female assigned Jemima Wilkerson now preaching as the public universal friend raises a lot of eyebrows.
Although during this first great awakening, there were a lot more women in the
it's the beginning of it.
Right.
You get Ann Lee with the Shakers, and, you know, it's the beginning of charismatic women starting to do this kind of thing. But, you know, in Puritan New England of the 1770s and 1780s.
17th century, it wouldn't have happened in a million billion years, but we're in the 18th century now, man.
This is a new time.
Come on.
Women can do anything they want to do.
Sure. We've got compasses.
Or like one of them can be a nurse and one of them can deliver water on the battlefield.
I mean, one of them can really, really mastermind her husband's presidency.
who are we into here? Dolly Madison?
No.
Abigail Adams.
Abigail Adams.
I see. Maybe both. Maybe sure. they, maybe
Dolly
they're
Madison probably did.
Maybe
too.
They're both the real power behind the throne. I think Sally Hemings was president briefly when Thomas Jefferson got a colonoscopy. A lot of people don't know that. The
Eleanor Roosevelt is still my president.
That's a good bumper sticker. A big part of the public universal friends theology and where the friend separates from the Quakers and why their local congregation quickly bounces them all in turn. You can see the records of this. This is one of the few places where there are firsthand records of the public universal friend before the friend begins preaching, is the local Quakers being like, and we kicked out Jemima's sister Sarah for not disavowing Jemima. And we now kicked out Jemima's dad, Jebediah, for not disavowing Jemima. So the Quakers are still dead naming Jemima. Problematic.
Right.
The friend wants more spiritual gifts, a religion of gifts of prophecy and faith healing, you know, big charismatic theatrical religion, of which the New Testament is full, but of which Puritan New England thinks is a little suspect,
it's a little garish,
ill-behaved. Yeah, you don't want to go to church and have somebody heal somebody or predict the future.
But let me ask you, to come out of a transcendent experience where you meet the angels and you come back to life as a new being, I could see saying, I am now the friend. And if you wanted to transcend all local religions, you could say, I am the universal friend. But to put public, to append public there is an interesting, you know, like, what is the purpose of that?
What two adjectives would you choose if you had arose from a religious epiphany and decided you were going to become a prophet?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would pick public and universal.
No, right. And public indicates, well, certainly that the public universal friend is not going to retreat to the wilderness and sit and stare at a pond.
And make silverware.
It's an activist name.
I'm for everyone, and I'm going to do it in public. And that's exactly, yeah. I think that's exactly what's being emphasized, because the friend does become a traveling minister, you know, a traveling preacher, leaves Rhode Island, heads to the big city, heads to Philadelphia. I think universal may refer to the doctrine the friend preaches of universal salvation.
Oh, I see.
Like it's the Christian idea of universalism, the controversial or possibly even heretical notion that God will save all his children. Even before the friend leaves Rhode Island, the friend is attracting wayward Quakers. Did you ever see Wayward Quakers when they opened for,
yeah,
for Pavement?
Yeah, they were great. They always played the Middle East in Boston.
You know, because there are many people born into Quaker homes who are later like, no, man, I love the new stuff. I love faith healing, and I love... So it was very easy to find, including influential ones. You know, within just a few years, a justice on the Rhode Island Supreme Court is a follower of the friend.
And Nixon.
And David Byrne. Captain in the Continental Army is a follower of the public universal friend. The Society of Universal Friends, as the friend names the friend's new religion. The
Society of Universal Friends is the product of Puff? Suff is from Puff?
Well, there's already been the Society of Friends.
Right.
Okay. So this is the Society of Universal Friends, a Quaker offshoot. The Scions of Massachusetts Shipbuilders. Suddenly the friend has like...
Also a great restaurant.
Is it called Massachusetts Shipbuilders or is it called the Scion of Massachusetts?
The Scion of Massachusetts Shipbuilders.
The friend suddenly has money and clout and heads to the Society of Universal Friends. I mean, this is kind of problematic, but for decades, feminist scholars have referred to this as the first American religion founded by a woman because of how Jemima Wilkerson was assigned to birth, how the friend was assigned to birth when the friend was named Jemima Wilkerson.
Right.
Now that we're more eager
to... those are TERFs.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Now that we're more eager to claim or possibly, I mean, this is all retroactive, but to speculate on the trans or non-binary identity of the public universal friend, now it becomes a little more problematic to say this religion was founded by a woman.
Right.
But it was certainly a religion founded by somebody that the religion society considered a woman, which you got to give some points for, I guess. That was harder to do back then.
Baby steps.
On that side of the aisle.
In the 18th century.
When the friend heads to Philadelphia, there starts to be some opposition.
So the friend, by all accounts, was very charismatic speaker and personage. The friend isn't accruing all this notice by being a boring talker.
Well, I think the friend is a by virtue of the friend's mystical experience and just the friend's unusual garb and presence, the friend attracts attention. I mean, none of these doctrines seem all that interesting or unusual. And, you know, this starts to butt up against The Great Awakening, where everybody and his dog is taking to a pulpit and being like, guess what? I've got the gift of healing from the New Testament. You know, there's
right.
These become a dime a dozen. There's something in the water. But yeah,
it's their version of making an app.
It's their version of starting a podcast. Back then, instead of starting a podcast, you would speak in tongues.
Yeah.
It's not that different, honestly.
No, we're both wearing our radioactive proof robes.
I'm wearing purple, non-binary conforming robes right now. In Philadelphia, as the friend starts to address crowds, that's when angry people start to write into newspapers and magazines.
Those angry people are still in Philadelphia today.
Most of them are in Boston, but yeah, probably some in Philadelphia. Didn't this happen to when we did America's Joan of Arc? She'd start to go to northeastern cities and there'd be angry letters.
Yeah.
And maybe this is just when any woman appears in any northeastern city and any time in the past, you get angry men showing up in the papers.
The problem is San Francisco hadn't been invented yet.
So, when the friend speaks at the friend's meetings, there are now hecklers who are basically like, thou art neither man nor woman.
Right.
What are thee?
Rhubarb.
You know, the equivalent of, you know, today's kind of,
thou art neither man nor woman.
Non-progressive, internet discourse or Ben Shapiro, broadcast or whatever right. It is. And the friend actually like gets the crowd back. The friend's what in response to this kind of heckling, the friend says, there is nothing indecent or improper in my dress or appearance. I am not accountable to mortals.
Wow.
I always go, that's a big jump, by the way. That's a big jump from my dress. Isn't that weird too? I am accountable to no mortal authority.
Kapow.
And then there's an even bigger jump.
Cause that sounds a little bit like a sovereign citizen, take on things.
Sovereign citizen. And then the third thing the friend says is, I am that I am. Which,
that's all
know,
that I am.
I mean, to you, it just sounds like Popeye. But to a person of faith, that's actually the burning bush to Moses saying, I am that I am.
Oh, I see.
Or Jesus to the Pharisees saying, before Abraham was, I am. This is a claim of godhood.
Sure. I am that I am.
So the friend, you know,
what
having
is that been, in Greek? That's actually a word in Greek that can be interpreted a couple of ways.
On Latino pop radio, I think it's soy lo que soy. A number one hit for 8 weeks on the Latin charts. Is there a Greek word?
11 Grammy nominations.
11 Latin Grammys for Enrique with Soy Lo Que Soy.
My ancient Greek is rusty.
I'm afraid mine is too. Do we care enough to look this up?
That's a third thing.
Let's give some homework. So the friend at this point is basically claiming, I've been sent back from heaven with angelic authority. I'm basically...
Right.
And this is what people say about the friend when they write about the friend is, you know, the friend is claiming to be a new Messiah, a second coming of Christ.
But the friend is not claiming that they can't be prosecuted for shoplifting.
Basically, I'm not accountable to mortals.
Wow.
I'm going to go into your dry goods store and I'm going to take what I need for my ringlets.
Sure.
And as you can imagine, Philadelphia in the 1780s does not respond well, in the late 1770s does not respond well to this. There are riots, bricks and sticks, and the lot are thrown at the house where the friend is staying in Philadelphia. And at one point, the papers even have accusations of a murder. Somebody, a follower of the Society of Universal Friends, is staying with a local Philadelphian woman named Sarah Wilson, who, I don't know, dies in her sleep or has a bad dream or something. But then, you know, the papers blame the friend follower who is in the home. And then through a game of telephone, they start to say, oh yeah, this was the public universal friend. The public universal friend killed that woman, Sarah Wilson.
Killed her in her dreams?
I don't know. Hmm. The newspaper accounts are vague and get better every time the story is told and then get colored by later 19th century propaganda about what a terrible rabble rouser, the troublemaker, the friend was. So in 1780, after, you know, literally accusations of murder are troubling the friend in Philadelphia.
It should be noted during the war.
Yeah, this is all true. And, you know, the revolution we often think of as a time of, you know, we think of it as a secular event, but considering the religious climate at the time, there must have been both obviously religious reasons for the separation, you know, enumerated in the, if nothing else, in the separation of church and state in the,
right.
In the call, the Patriot founding father writers, and then later in the Constitution. but also it must have caused a great deal of religious upheaval, you know? If you're looking for a secular explanation of the friend's collapse, you know, it may be a mental breakdown caused by a religious crisis coupled with the beginning of the American Revolution.
Because, right, we would have been fighting also against Anglicanism.
Sure.
And all of its sort of trappings.
We're a comparatively pluralist set of colonies.
Right. Although that wouldn't have been the take from Massachusetts and Rhode Island.
But there was a Catholic colony, a Puritan colony, a dissenter colony, right. And so forth. A William Penn, a Quaker colony.
And I guess Philadelphia would have been the place where all of that was it most admixed.
Yeah, it's a Quaker colony, but it's a, you know, it's the biggest city, so it's full of
capital city
people from all over. So yeah, this is a time of incredible upheaval, and which we see reflected in
people were doing other things too, like fighting the British all around.
Yeah, so this,
and fighting the Scots-Irish too. Let's be honest,
as usual. So in 1780, facing an unwelcome crowd or unwelcome authorities in Philadelphia, the Public Universal Friend does what you would expect.
Ascend directly to heaven.
Is that what you want?
Well, sort of.
What did a religious movement back then facing big city authorities do back then, John?
Oh, they loaded up the Conestoga wagon and they headed over the mountains.
They headed to the great American frontier.
Yay!
Which was then the Finger Lakes region of New York. So we have yet another upstate New York.
And still.
You still consider that the frontier?
There's really nothing up there.
That was...
No offense to all
that was a place to get away. That was a place to find land and comparative, political freedom.
Right.
Away from any authorities. You would just keep heading west. You'd still be in what is today New York State. The Society of Universal Friends starts up in the wilds of upstate New York, just as the Oneida people and the Mormons and all the other upstate New York kind of religions. I don't know. Is that where Millerism starts, which eventually gives you Adventism and indirectly the Jehovah's Witnesses? I mean, it was a hotbed
That's
for
where
a lot
Mormonism
of,
started.
I already mentioned.
Oh, did you?
I already mentioned us.
Sorry.
I led with us. But sadly, this is not a success story.
There's really nothing up there. Let's
to this
let's,
day.
Let's be honest. I mean, there's between Rochester, Ithaca, and Syracuse. I've been all over there, and could start a new religious movement any day.
I spent the night in Rochester, just taking the kids to Niagara Falls once, and it was kind of an oddly post-apocalyptic scenario. I don't know. Maybe Rochesterian listeners. What do you think the demonym is? Rochestonians?
Rochesterinos.
Rochesterinos? Rochesterites?
You know, it's named after an ancestor of mine.
Rochester from the Jack Benny show?
No,
right. You were the Rochesters before you were the Rogers.
Yeah. So, and Nathaniel Rochester is I'm an actual descendant.
Can you explain what the weird kind of post-apocalyptic vibe at the Target I went to in Rochester a couple summers ago?
You know, Rochester was part of the American industrial heartland.
There is that.
The problem is nobody, you know, makes things in America anymore.
All the tanning mills or whatever that used to pollute those rivers are gone.
Yeah.
I think it is some of that.
The carburetor manufacturers, fuel injection is what killed it, Ken.
But up there in the wilds of Yates County, New York, things do not go well for the Society of Universal Friends.
Oh no.
It takes decades.
This was just post Indian Wars too. I mean, there are a lot of,
sure.
This is contentious.
It is the frontier.
Yeah.
For one thing, it's mostly what you would expect, schisms from within. The Friend has all these high-profile followers. They are all male, so they have a lot more clout in the society.
And they're trying to explain to the Friend what the Friend is really saying.
Exactly. At some point, they're like, wait, why are we following this oddly gender-coded person around? I'm a successful shipbuilder. I'm a white male. I know what's up.
I'm a damn builder.
And it ends with a lot of these successful male followers breaking away, accusing the Friend of blasphemy.
Oh dear!
And some of them take her to court. Some of them take the Friend to court.
But the Friend is not beholden to any mortal.
Well, in that case, that turns out to be true. The case is immediately thrown out because New York State has no law against blasphemy, which shocks all the moneyed white men who are like, I thought we had a
wasn't that a thing?
Him or they. The trouble is the Society of Universal Friends has kind of taken over a big tract, like 14,000 acres, up in Yates County, New York. But
did they start at Chautauqua?
Kind of. Someone named the public universal friend who refuses to sign documents as Jemima Wilkinson has no legal rights. So the friend refused to actually sign any of the deeds or paperwork or bank documents related to this huge tract of land.
Oh, so it was all owned in the name of some...
of just her high profile, of the friend's high profile male followers.
Right.
So once there were bad feelings, it was very easy for them to just take the whole homestead. And basically
subdivide it and turn it into a bedroom community of Syracuse.
What it is today. And there was also the problem caused by the friend just absolutely sticking by celibacy for the friend's followers. You can see how that would be trouble for a new religion.
I mean, that's a drag, frankly.
You mean...
I feel like if you're going to start a new religion, it should be about...
It should be a sex cult like the Oneida people.
It should be about doing it rather than not doing it.
Of the two LL Cool J songs, Doing It and Not Doing It.
I ride for doing it.
I was born in Yates County. She was raised out of Brooklyn. And so it's not just the problem of attracting new followers to a celibacy cult or sect. It's also keeping up the numbers once you're in the celibacy sect.
You got to grow it.
You got to grow from within. And that's just not happening in a cult where all the, or cult, in a sect where all the most prestige is associated with not doing it.
Right.
Never taking off your purple robes. So their numbers dwindle. But by the end of the friend's life, despite that kind of burst of Philadelphia publicity in the 1770s, followed by the hopeful, flight to the frontier to begin a new life in a new American city on the hill. Numbers are thin. It's all coming. It's kind of like whatever happened to the Shakers. For the same reason they were not shaking it in the bedroom. The friend begins to suffer from heart condition. And on July 1st, 1819, the friend passes away of congestive heart failure. The friend's remaining followers, for a while, they think the friend's going to come back. They're like, let's just sit by the body. This is our UFO cult from Chicago.
Sure, that's only gonna fly for 3 or 4 days, though.
And that's exactly what happens. None of their justifications are continuing to hold up, and I'm sure the smell's not great.
Right, fish and visitors, and also prophets.
Public universal friends go bad after 3 days.
You know, I've actually been to an extant Shaker colony.
I have too,
in Western Massachusetts.
I wonder if that. I think we were at the same one. Isn't there one in the Berkshires?
Yeah.
It just exists to sell furniture now, right?
Well, no, it was I knew a friend's father had departed the earthly realms, but didn't want
to
actually...
Is it offensive to say a Shaker dies?
But didn't actually want to die, and so went and became a Shaker and lived in the compound, and they... And we
the last Shaker convert, possibly.
Yeah, and it was in the forest, and it was a proper Shaker colony from the early 19th century. All the buildings still. We had a communal meal there. It was.
I've been to the gift shop of one of these, and I wonder if it was the same one.
Yeah, what were you doing there?
I was just passing through, and you want to look at the cool old furniture.
Sure. No, this was a.
And this was presented as a historical site. You know, there were plaques for this is where Mother Ann Lee did this or that.
Oh no, this felt very weird I know we're resisting saying cult, but like it felt like summer campy, but active, and everyone there was 60 years old. So it wasn't like, hey, it's colonial America and we're wearing buckle hats. It was a bunch of people in sweatpants who were like...
Their cult referent had moved up through the centuries.
Yeah. They were definitely practicing something.
It got up to the 80s maybe by the time you were there.
It was like a lot of old deadheads, it felt like.
I mean, the descendants of the Society of Universal Friends are still around in Yates County. I mean, there's no religious apparatus, but like that's largely who peoples, as you refer to it as the wasteland of upstate New York. So there's still historical museums where you can read up on the public universal friend, who was, I think, forgotten for decades after the kind of the 19th century wave of look at this weirdo propaganda died out.
There would have been so many people wandering around the frontier wearing a homemade crown.
Saying that they were second Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did the public universal friend become the focus of scholarship and denunciation?
I mean, recent years, it's, you can't, there were, you know, for there was a wave of feminist recognition.
Right.
Like, look at this brave person subverting gender, this brave woman, they would have said, subverting gender roles and founding this first American female-led religion. But of course, today, it seems like a much better fit to say, you know, part of the public universal friend's personal crisis may have been a matter of gender identity. You know, today we would describe somebody in their 20s who suddenly has an epiphany and is like, I don't feel at home in my own body. I'm going to start coding my clothing and my pronouns differently. Like, that's a non-binary or a trans person.
Right.
So today there's been a lot of LGBT scholarship around the public universal friend. And again, you know, it's, this is all kind of applying our definitions back in time, because, you know, even the friend self would not have had the references to agree, oh yes, you are correct, scholar at Amherst, I was non-binary.
Right.
Who knows if, you know, amid all the religious paraphernalia, what the friend self would have thought of that.
Well, there have always been trans people, and so
we did Lieutenant Nunn on the show.
Right. Looking back through history, and I mean, there are a lot of trans people that...
This is a likely candidate.
Yeah, made a transition, but there were a lot of trans people that weren't able to.
I mean, at some point we're going to be speculating on which signers of the Declaration of Independence or which right. American industrialists of the 19th century were probably trans and just never came out.
Right.
That'll be, it's no different than the way we consider, you know, a lot of closeted gay historical people.
Right.
Today.
I mean, how many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were gay? It has to be a noble percentage.
By the numbers, it has to be around 83% of them. And I'm going to name them right now. Cesar Rodney, 100%. Button Gwinnett, absolutely.
Right, Stephen right there.
Stephen Hopkins of Rhode Island, look, we all knew it. We were all saying it. We all saw the hats.
Right. It's easier to name the signers of the Declaration of Independence who weren't gay or trans.
It'll just be a shorter list. I mean, they're all wearing stockings and little breeches. No. But, you know, these things kind of are, you know, the way we see gender is kind of societally based. You mentioned the frontier and the Indian Wars of this time. You know, there are plenty of Native American populations that even at this time would have said, oh, no, there's clearly five genders, or there's, you know, they had their own number,
right?
You know,
well, the frontier allows for a lot of fluidity in the sense that, look, man, you can't always, if you know, you all hands on deck kind of thing, you know, like you can't be
right. You can't tell, you know, we might need women to do this, right. Or it's interesting that we've done two of these stories now. I think were they both requests? Maybe one was not, but they both take place in the New World, you know, in this family of, person assigned a woman at birth who later lives this kind of very non-conforming life in all respects.
Right.
And, you know, when it comes to Lieutenant Nunn, it was, what, robbing stagecoaches and right. slicing off people's goatees. With the public universal friend, it's being the second coming and and starting a cult in upstate New York. But I wonder if that's a New World thing, you know, away from the strictures of the old world. You know, this was the hemisphere for gender exploration and exploration of sexuality as well, despite the, you know, the early Puritan stamp.
I mean, I feel like Elizabeth I was probably trans.
Wow.
And
this is a strong stance for the
Joan of Arc. I mean, I think you can find a lot of, you can find a lot of antecedents. It's just that,
I guess you don't want to fall into the trap of saying, you know, every strong woman from history was actually not a woman, you
right.
know,
I think it's in the hairstyles. It's the severe bangs that you shall know them.
Although Yates County is still full of Society of Universal Friends descendants in history, you cannot visit the public Universal Friends gravesite.
Oh,
it was not made public. The friends were afraid that the gravesite would be, you know, desecrated by the friends' opponents, whether from in or out of the sect.
So there is a grave, but it is hidden in the trees?
we assume that the public universal friend was buried somewhere. I know you want to think that the friend ascended, but there's no evidence of this, sadly.
But is there like a place where people in the...
No, like, it's not just that there's no marking. Like, we don't know where the body was laid to rest today.
Hmm.
So I guess all of the wilds of upstate New York are a monument.
Equally possible.
I mean, the friend was public and universal.
Right.
So seems appropriate.
And that concludes The Public Universal Friend, entry 1006.JE3122, certificate number 29297 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event...
Sorry, I'm opening the mail. Is this too loud?
No, it's wonderful.
Should we do the Quaker noises?
In the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram are archived at Omnibus Project. Our handles were at Ken Jennings and at John Roderick.
It's kind of a spooky Quaker meeting.
Yeah, this is the voice of God coming in through the cracks in the windowsill. Our address for email, which was a popular form of written electronic communication, was theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can find other futurelings on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. You can send us mail, and Ken is opening some right now.
For you,
even John. Louder than I'm speaking.
It's although you're listening to this just after Christmas, John's about to get an early holiday present here.
P.O. Box 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155. It doesn't need to be a holiday to send us wonderful gifts. What do you got over there?
Mike wanted you to have this.
Hi, Mike. Thank you, John.
On the box it says, special delivery for you. From Taste Coffee Roasters.
Say what?
Mike says, John, hopefully this is better than the donut shop coffee K-cups you get. Were you complaining about bad coffee at some point?
Yeah, well, you know, I've been using one of those Keurig. It's garbage coffee, but it... Someone bought me a Keurig at one point, and because I had an office downtown and I didn't want to have all the rigmarole of real coffee... And so when I unpacked the boxes, I didn't put my coffee maker in a proper box. I taped it to the roof of my car and it blew away. So I've been using this Keurig, and it was initially supposed to be just like for the first week I was living in my house. Well, here it is. I've been there now a year. And
you're still drinking bad coffee?
Still drinking terrible coffee.
Well, those days are over.
What is all this?
You have received... a mug from Taste Coffee Roaster saying, and you're going to laugh, life happens, coffee helps.
Hey, life happens. And man. Taste, it should be noticed, is spelled with a Y.
It is.
T-A-Y-S-E.
You got 10 single serve pods each of two of Taste's roasts, Bold and Brazen.
Oh, they're pods.
And Medium and Heroic.
Oh, all four of those are descriptors of me.
Well, even though... No, I'm a medium.
Oh, you are.
You're heroic.
You're the perfect medium.
These are...
Like agar. I'm
the public universal medium. I just spilled water all over this Star Trek Gold Key comic that's been sitting here for a few weeks.
You got to get that up. You got to mop that up, Ken. All right, let's see here.
I was thoughtfully brought a glass of water, but I forgot it was right behind my laptop.
Golden Brazen, totally true of us both.
But the thing is, even though this is aren't coffee pods famously bad for the environment, and those are packaged in.
Well, but this says the pods are 100% compostable, and this what would appear to us to be a foil bag, it says the bag is 100% compostable.
How is that possible? It's foil.
Well, I don't think it is. Foil. I think it's some magic thing made out of potatoes.
The other accoutrement here include like a weird random piece of burlap.
Okay,
to convince you of the eco sustainability of this coffee.
Nothing says eco like burlap.
Two wooden clothespins that you can use to reclose your coffee foil bags that are not foil.
Probably won't do that, but I'll use these somewhere else.
And a piece of twine. Just again to go with the burlap to randomly make you think that this is sustainable.
Maybe the twine and burlap are meant to be I'm meant to fashion them into a kind of loincloth.
Maybe you're supposed to tie them around your nipples. It's not clear. But that was nice, Mike. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. If you are not in a position where you can send us or me coffee,
Because don't send me the devil's bean.
Yeah, Ken doesn't drink the evil stuff.
He right only now, I'm drinking the only thing I ever drink, tepid water.
That's not true. You drink Diet Dr. Pepper. But you can support the show more directly at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Your contributions not only help us make the show, but also at a certain level, you're entitled to suggest a show topic, and that like is Alex true did today. Of the public universal friend.
Yes. If you're ever thinking, should I support Omnibus on Patreon, or should I put that same money to work sending John high-end coffee? Please do not send John high-end coffee. Are we going to fight about this?
No.
Are you bold and brazen?
No, I've got my coffee. I'm medium and heroic. I've got my coffee. You can support the show directly at patreon.com.
Listeners, I'm just breaking down boxes now.
Yeah, sure.
This is the new soundtrack. Sure. It's ASMR.
You're literally dressed as a postal worker today.
Why do you think I'm dressed as a postal worker? Because I'm wearing a sweater.
Well, no, it's the particular color of that cardigan sweater and the and the light blue shirt underneath it. You really just you either work at Amtrak or you're a postal worker. I mean, it's a good look on you.
Thank you. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. If it all ends today, I will be found in the rubble dressed as a postman. Of course, we hope and pray that catastrophe will never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final one. But if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.